the title for this panel was taken, I think, from Don Siegel's book, which was Lakshin to Lomi. And it has been, I think, a subject for all three of us on the panel of some real fascination. I'm just thrilled. Gail Tuckman is the co-author of an academic article, New York Jews and Chinese Food, The Social Construction of an Ethnic Pattern, which she wrote with Harry Levine. And Qiqi Wang is a wonderful cook and a wonderful writer who writes something called the Nasty Bits column for Serious Eats. Born in Shanghai and raised in New Mexico, she has her degree in philosophy, but decided that writing about food would be more fun than writing about Plato, which I think is hard to argue with. She was also the creator, I think it's it. Can I say that you were the creator of Woks and Loks?
I was the cook, and I had two producers who put on the event, so.
Right. The very first public Jewish and Asian Christmas. I'll let her talk more about her Chinese-Jewish menu. And why don't we start with Gay, who will present a little bit, and then Qiqi will, and then I'll ask them some questions, and then we will open it up to questions from the audience. I'm sorry to say that there is no food being provided. I know, it's sad, I know.
I've discovered over the years that I'm much more concise if I use a script, so I'm going to. So I sit before you, a refugee from the Upper West Side, where I lived from 1972 to 1990. Almost a year ago, the blog West Side Rag announced Chinese food was practically a religion on the Upper West Side in the 1980s and 90s, but that era is mostly over. The emergence of other Asian foods and the gradual decline of local Chinese food has left a hole in the heart of the neighborhood. However, the Upper West Side still has lots of shuls. Almost 25 years ago, my colleague Carrie Levine and I were eating some terrific broccoli pizza at La Pineda Pizzeria, which was across the street from our offices. And we jumped from discussing food to discussing Chinese food. We had both gone to Brandeis, and where we were both taught that you could think big about the littlest things, and an article on Jews and Chinese food came out of that. It helped that we came from two very different backgrounds. My family was somewhat observant, and Harry's was some degree of politically left, which are the two great Jewish traditions in the New York area. It also helped that we both believe that ethnic groups create their own cultural patterns, and that these are reconstructed from generation to generation. So I thought Don was going to be here, so what I wrote took that for granted, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, he was
but,
not able to
understand the process. Don was very sympathetic to one of our arguments in his book, and I'm just going to reprise it very, very briefly. And that is that Chinese food is safe trafe. It's so minced that you can eat it almost without knowing that you're engaging in sin. It's hard to find the trafe, for instance, in egg rolls without deconstructing them, which is a fashionable term, but would be very messy if they've been deep fried. You know, so that is one reason that people like to think that Jews, say, in the teens and 20s in New York and other urban centers along the East Coast started eating Chinese food. The point is, as the cultural historian and sociologist Raymond Williams once argued, that culture spawns the terms of its own rejection. Adventurous souls and rebels can disavow the strictures of a food-oriented culture by eating forbidden food. When I moved to Connecticut, I met a graduate student, actually a graduate student in my department, who was also a New York expatriate, and she went to the shul that my son and I had joined. The rabbi was terrible, just terrible. So terrible that one Rosh Hashanah, she left in the middle of his sermon and went to a Chinese restaurant. That was her statement of rebellion. So food-oriented rebellion cannot be accomplished with any substance or any forbidden substance. It cannot be food that looks so like prohibited fare that it automatically triggers revulsion. I remember my high school English teacher talked about going to see a movie with a Jewish girl. He was Hungarian Catholic. And in this particular movie, a character had turkey leg and milk, and his date had to run out of the theater to throw up. So it's not just anything. Okay? And it can't be food that requires some training to eat, like a whole lobster. You have to know what you're doing. So our article stressed that Chinatown was near the Jewish Lower East Side. You have to be able to get to a restaurant to eat the food. You know, that was pre-car days. And the food seemed sophisticated, and the food was also unchristian. Being unchristian is no small matter to immigrants who had experienced Christian prejudices in Europe. In the 1922 book, The Immigrant Press and Its Control, an early sociologist named Robert Park quoted an advice column in a Yiddish newspaper that said, essentially, if a Gentile offers to take your hand and walk in the woods, check the other hand for a gun. So I've heard guys who would now be in their late 90s and went to school in or around the Lower East Side talk about the problems they experienced cutting across a Catholic neighborhood to get to public school back when they were kids. One recalled that the Italian kids used to try to unbutton his fly. Today, that specific version of what I'm going to call intense ethnocentrism, to be polite about it, is as difficult to remember as the fact that buttons were once used to fasten boys' pants and that Jews were not always considered white. So, although Chinese restaurants were unchristian, Jews adopted Western or Christian attitudes toward Asian Americans. It's always more acceptable to adopt the ways of the dominant group, even if that group discriminates against you. Harry and I noted that as late as the 1950s, some of the Jews who ate in Chinese restaurants felt superior to Chinese Americans and used offensive terms to describe them. The words were so common that some kids didn't even know that those words were offensive. Today, there's been a grand transformation in American eating habits. Escoffier-inspired French cuisine no longer hogs the gastronomical heights of the urban restaurantdom. The Cooking Channel has popularized Americanized version of international foods. You just consider the restaurants that are associated with the various judges on Chopped. And the once Chinese food aficionados of the Upper West Side have embraced Indian cuisine, Thai food, and have even tried Ethiopian fare. Not merely the Cantonese versions, which continue to reign in some Jewish suburban ghettos. So I started my comments by noting that we eat a greater variety of foods now than we did, say, in the 1950s. And when and how we eat it has also changed. Harry and I talked about the Jews who in the 1950s ate Chinese on Sunday night. The blog in the West Side Rag talked about eating Chinese food on Friday night, I assume to celebrate the end of the work week with a meal other than the traditional Shabbos dinner. And additionally, and this matters, New York Jews eat Chinese food collectively, or at least used to. When my son and I moved to Connecticut, we went out with some new friends to a Chinese restaurant. They came from Maine and had just moved there also, and I was absolutely aghast. Everybody ordered their own dish and didn't share. Additionally, there's another change. It's no longer considered cool or acceptable to eat off other people's plates, which certainly used to be a custom, at least a custom that I grew up with. There's also been some transformation of ethnic hatreds, at least among the whites who have been in the United States for several or many generations. Today, the sociologists use the term Euro-Americans to discuss many white groups, noting that their expression of ethnicity mainly occurs symbolically through the attachment to some foods like pizza or bagels, and holidays like St. Patrick's Day, which now seems simply downright American. But amidst tacos stuffed with kimchi and four-star restaurants associated with Japanese and European expatriates, some things remain very much the same. Learning the prejudices of the dominant groups becomes part, and still is part, of becoming American. Such matters as following customs and rejecting or refashioning them, making sense of America and finding a place in it, and expressing ethnic prejudices have culinary consequences.
Memoir about growing up in my Chinese immigrant mother's kitchen. And I guess the reason I'm on this panel, besides, you know, being Chinese and cooking a lot of Chinese food, is that a couple of months ago, two friends of mine approached me with the idea of cooking dinner for 60 very lonely Jewish and Chinese people on Christmas Eve. Lonely, their words, not mine. And I, being a lonely Chinese person, had really nothing better to do with myself, so I said, sure, why not? And so my friends who were producing the event basically gave me 100% creative control over the menu, which was great. The big caveat being that the restaurant in Queens that agreed to host the event was actually vegetarian. And so, you know, I had ideas for, like, the felted fish dumplings and chocolate liver wontons, but I didn't make it into the menu because of that reason. But that still sort of left a lot to work with. And so I thought that, you know, we bandied around a few ideas for what we would cook. And at first I thought, well, why don't I cook a traditional Chinese banquet with some of the dishes that I grew up eating from my mother's kitchen? But then I realized that if a bunch of lonely Jewish and Chinese people wanted Chinese food on Christmas Eve, they could go to any number of the Chinese restaurants in any of the Chinatowns in the city. So we scrapped that idea, and we decided that what we were gonna do was to cook a menu of traditional Jewish American foods with a Chinese twist. And so I thought I would tell you guys a little bit about what I cooked that evening. So I'm just gonna give you sort of a short recounting of what happened. So the evening started really well. When the guests arrived at the restaurant, we already had some appetizers on the table for them. So I had cut up some bagels and stir-fried them with sriracha and soy sauce so that the edges got really crispy, but there was still this kind of like chewy tenderness in the middle of each bagel strip. And we whipped cream cheese and set it in little mason jars by the bagel strips. And the night before, well, there were many nights before, but a few nights before, we had also sliced many, many pounds of cucumbers and daikon, which is a sort of a Japanese or Chinese radish. And I had pickled them in a brine of rice wine vinegar and sugar and salt, but then added in a bunch of sprigs of dill and garlic. So that was supposed to be a play on the half sours that you get at these Jewish delis. So those were the appetizers. And then for the soup, I made matzo ball soup. And the matzo balls were pretty, you know, run-of-the-mill traditional matzo balls, but not with schmaltz, with vegetable oil. And I realized as I was making the matzo balls that I had very definite opinions about whether the matzo balls ought to be floaters or sinkers. I like mine to be a little bit in between because I want the dexterity of, you know, the chewiness of a sinker, but sort of the ethereal quality of a floater. So floaters somewhere in the middle. And I serve them in like this ginger shiitake broth that I put with bamboos and wood ear mushrooms. So it was like a very traditional Chinese broth, but with matzo balls. So those were the appetizers and then the soup course. And then we had three main dishes, which I'd also made up the night before, like 20 or 30 pounds worth of, because remember I was feeding 25 people for the dinner portion of the evening. So we had Kasia Renishkas. I had never even heard of Kasia Renishka, but it's apparently a fairly traditional dish of bow tie pasta and kasha.
The Jews are not.
They're all nodding.
And everybody else is thinking, I've never heard of that.
And I had never heard of the dish, and maybe in the Q&A portion of the panel, we can have a discussion as to why there is even a relationship between kasha and bow tie pasta.
They're both cheap.
They're both cheap, okay. But I had cooked both of them.
There we go.
It's a textural contrast between like the smooth pasta and the grainy.
Okay, yeah, okay, I can see that.
Yeah.
So
it's like a yin yang thing.
Okay. Just like
that.
We had made that, and I had tossed it in sort of like scallion oil with soy sauce and like different spices like cinnamon and star anise that was toasted and then ground. And then for the second course, there was tofu, which I had encrusted in matzo meal and deep fried, and then served with General To sauce. Tau sauce, which is a very classic Chinese American dish that, you know, not only Jewish people but everyone seems to love. If anybody wants the recipe for it, it's on Serious Eats. It's a really great sauce. And so, you know, these like very tender cubes of tofu that had been deep fried in matzo were then smothered in this sauce. Oh, it was so good. And then for the third main course, I made up wonton pierogies. So basically, pierogi filling that was wrapped inside wonton wrappers, which were then parboiled and pan-fried at the restaurant. And so what went into the filling was potatoes and shredded cheddar cheese and farmer's cheese, but then also with an assortment of Chinese seasonings. So there was sesame oil and soy sauce and a little bit of fish sauce, which was my not-to-Vietnamese cuisine. And so, you know, there are a lot of people there, and it's a tiny kitchen, and I'm knocking out these dishes one by one, and the evening's progressing fairly well. And meanwhile, there's klezmer music blaring on the speakers. And klezmer music, for those of you, like the two people in the audience who might not know what it is that very like expressive music with those wailing clarinets and the fast-paced violin. And it's the music that gets featured on Fiddler on the Roof, so it's like, right, so that music is playing in the background, and that's when we hit the last of the main courses, which is Szechuan peppercorn latkes. I had committed to cooking latkes because who doesn't like deep fried potatoes? So I thought, why not? But you know, latkes are very delicate creatures prior to their setting in the pan because they're just shredded potatoes bound with almost nothing. I'm getting a lot of noise, which is good. Burns. And so the klezmer music is blaring in the background, and I'm cooking latkes for 25 people, each of whom wants, you know, three very large latkes. And all of a sudden, I find myself flipping these latkes with more and more mechanical accuracy and ardor, but I'm also feeling very happy and productive at the same time, and then I realize it's because of the music. And so now, whenever you know I'm at my desk writing and I need a little pick me up, I always play the music because it just gets and so, no, really, the latkes weren't that bad. I think it was just the fact that I had to cook for so many people. And then after the dinner portion, 40 more people arrived, and they were expecting latkes too. So all in all, I think I made something like 300 latkes that evening. And so, on top of the 500 wontons, which all had to be pan-fried. So it was a lot of standing in this tiny kitchen cooking for with a group of lonely Asians and Jews who are becoming less lonely by the minute. And that was pretty much it. We finished with dessert. And dessert was red bean rucola, so that's just rucola dough with a filling of red bean paste. And I have really, really strong opinions that rucola dough should be half cream cheese and half butter, none of this sour cream nonsense. So because cream cheese makes the dough really tangy and flaky, and I think those are just so important in rucola, so we have rucola. And we also made spring roll blintzes, which, so you just take spring roll wrappers and fill them with, you know, mince fillings of cream cheese and farmer cheese, and then we served it with applesauce that had been spiked with this ginger concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the Asian, the Chinese part of the meal. And it was a great night. I had a great time, and you know, it was probably one of the only events in which it's perfectly acceptable to go up to somebody and say, "Are you Jewish?" And you can find all of these recipes on Serious Eats, because I posted about it. So if you want to learn how to make red bean arugula, you can. And so that was the evening. So what did I learn that evening? What did I learn from this crazy Jewish-Chinese Christmas Eve? Well, first of all, I'm never going to commit to making latkes for 60 people ever again in my life. Secondly, that cream cheese actually explodes when you put it in a spring wrapper and try to deep fry it, so not that again. But third, one important thing that I did learn was that for most of my life, I had been kind of lonely on Christmas and Christmas Eve, but just had never recognized that I was lonely. And so that evening taught me sort of about what was going on. And I think that in a way, Chinese people are even lonelier than Jews around the holidays, because at least there's Hanukkah for the Jewish culture and the community. Whereas most Chinese immigrant families in America are atheist or agnostic, or just not even that. They don't talk about religion. It's not really part of their head. And so, you know, for years, the traditional Christmas meal in my household was Pizza Hut's extra large supreme pizza, which I didn't even want because I wanted like the little personal pan pizzas with pepperoni on them. And so I realized by cooking dinner for all of these Jewish and Chinese people on Christmas Eve that these rituals are important. Even if you're not a sentimental person, and I'm not, these rituals are important if only because, you know, they mark the passing of time. And so that's one Christmas Eve that I'll never forget as a result. And I personally think that I'm just gonna keep up the tradition. I mean, why not make it a tradition of your own, as the professor was saying. unless, of course, I marry into some waspy family that is Christmas. Otherwise, I'll be fine. So that was my evening.
Thank you. When I sat down, I asked Gigi and Gay both if they thought I could start the question and the question answer part with a joke. And she said to me, because I know she knows, she said, "There's only one good joke about Jews and Chinese food." I said, "I know." And so I feel that I won the coin toss. So I get to tell it. A Jewish man and Chinese man are talking things over. The Jewish man says to the Chinese man, "You have a very wise and ancient culture." And the Chinese guy goes, "Yes, our culture is over 4,000 years old, but you Jews, you're also very wise. You also have a very old culture." The Jewish man says, "Yes, I know. Our culture, as a matter of fact, 5,000 years old." The Chinese man goes, "That's actually impossible. Where did you people eat for 1,000 years?" I grew up in a family in which if we could have lived in a Chinese restaurant, we would have. It was not the case that we went there Thursday nights or Sunday nights. It was the case that we went there whenever we possibly could. And although in theory, everybody shared, what that really meant is that everybody had to share with my father. Wasn't really, I mean, you were not allowed. It was considered unbelievably bad form to order your own. We were kids, so obviously we weren't ordering our own anything. But you basically had to, I still remember this, and I actually said to my sister once, I said, "If you ever find when you're in a restaurant, you find yourself building little barricades around your food." She said, "Only when I'm in a Chinese restaurant." Because you wanted to hold on at least to your egg roll and your duck sauce, you know, until the middle of the evening. The things that strike me, the things that are always interesting to me about food and about recipes and about cultural habits, I would say, are this idea of the rebellion, that the culture seeds its own, you know, sows the seeds of its own rebellion, I think is very true with food. I think for all of us who made an effort to raise our children eating vegetables and, you know, fruit leather or whatever terrible versions there were during the period that we were raising our children, you know there's going to be a period where there's nothing but French fries and cigarettes. What is always interesting to me, and now I have great sympathy for my mother's position, which was always, as I was growing up, just wait. and now I find that only by putting my hands in my pockets can I restrain myself from saying that to my children, because I cannot wait to see what their kids are going to eat. But it is also true in my family that if you want a night in which everybody gets what they want, which I think is also one of the great appeals of the Chinese restaurant, is the possibility both of flavor and abundance and possibility, that people can order things that are entirely familiar, they can order things that they have only thought about. You can go, you can have shark fin soup, or you can have egg roll that you recognize 40 paces away as being the egg roll of your childhood. One of the things that I wondered about, and this is not to make you Chi Chi's sort of spokesman for a universe, but I'm very aware of the fact that Jews talk about Chinese food all the time. I'm very aware of the fact that Jews talk about food all the time, but Chinese food is really very, very high up on the list. I don't know if Chinese cooks, if people who cook Chinese food are sort of mindful of this, or if it's sort of a phenomenon that is discussed by the creators of the cuisine as well as by the consumers of the cuisine. So I sort of wondered about that. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Oh, what Chinese cooks think of the Jewish affinity for Chinese cuisine?
That would be fine too. I guess people are aware. Yes, it was sort of like, are people who are cooking and being innovative Chinese cooks sort of aware of this particularly large fan base that they have?
I think to a certain degree that most of my Chinese friends, and I certainly was very aware that Jews liked Chinese food. And I wasn't really quite sure why for a long time. And you know, in preparation for this panel, I tried to do a little research by going to Lower Manhattan and subjecting myself to repeat encounters with pastrami at Katz's and Russendonish bagels, and then going over to Chinatown and thinking that maybe the geographical proximity between Chinatown and the Lower East Side had something to do with the relationship. But I don't really think that's the case, because the two immigrant groups didn't overlap all that much.
Mm-hmm.
Is that maybe?
No, they were near, but they didn't overlap.
Yeah.
They're separate neighborhoods.
So I'm not sure that Chinese cooks are really all that aware. My mother and my aunts, who are all Chinese cooks, are always very flattered when Jewish friends come over for dinner, because they love everything. It's so easy to make Jewish friends happy at
a time. You've got people words to live by. There you go.
My mother, on the other hand, loves Jewish food. So she loves chopped liver, and I can't get enough of corned beef and pastrami and brisket. So and it's very much the case that I think both cultures place a premium on fatty foods and also on using lesser cuts of the animal. But that's true of a lot of immigrant communities. So I don't know if that's also a reason.
It's poor people food.
Poor people food.
But again, there are a lot of cultures that have poor people food. And so one of the things I always do circle back to, I mean, I wonder if this is just sort of one of those great mysteries of the culinary world, exactly what is the nature of that bond, because as you say, the fatty foods and the cheaper cuts of meat, but still there is something that drives this connection. I wonder if you have any more thoughts about that from your work or from your research.
I was actually seeing two things in my head.
Mm-hmm.
One was, there's a deli on near Route 8, on off Route 84 in Vernon.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't like
it. Bless their hearts.
Yeah, bless their hearts. I mean, for those of us who live in the northeast corner, it's desperation time. But their food is not as good as New York food. But I remember taking the mother of one of my son's classmates there about 1995. They were Chinese. And studying at UConn. And hearing somebody with a Chinese friend at the next table saying, "Oh, a crêpe, that's a Jewish wonton," And I have this other memory, since our Chinese friend very much liked sour food,
mm-hmm.
of ordering sweet and sour cabbage, and mine's makes it much, much too sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And we both completely concur that this was just slightly off. So there's some commonalities, but I think it's mainly the strangeness and the unchristianness. And that a lot of people nowadays don't like to think about that the way things were 100 years ago. You know, I mean, trying to think, my grandfather came to this country in 1907. In 1907, this wasn't a great place to be Jewish. And
well, but I wonder if there's a difference between, say, the kosher Jewish person's attitude towards Chinese food versus a Jewish person with more secular tastes.
Mm-hmm.
What you were mentioning, Professor, that
Harry and I both had the same passions. The only difference was that my family would order chicken fried rice and he would order pork fried rice. So that there would be, the thing about Chinese restaurants is that although they might not have been totally conscious of the fact that there were so many Jews going to them, they arranged the menus in ways that made it possible for someone who wanted to pretend that they weren't eating meat outside of their house to at least eat some meat that looked acceptable. So that it was possible to get chicken. It was possible to get beef. You didn't have to eat shrimp, lobster, or pork. And that was possibly, might have been the great divide between religious and non-religious Jews. Maybe.
I wanted to ask one more question. Gigi, do you see any particular sort of trends developing among, not so much among Jews eating Chinese food, because that's sort of now transcended a trend,
mm-hmm.
but among Chinese cooks, the direction of Chinese cooking is taking in this country, you see it sort of continuing to sort of morph and change?
Just in general?
Yeah, sort of in tastes in cooking or styles of cooking that are becoming more prominent in America than they had been.
Well, one thing that I think about a lot is this notion of Chinese food. China is so vast, and the provinces within China are kind of like, how Italians might think of themselves in the sense that somebody in Sichuan province doesn't think of their food as being Chinese food, it's Sichuanese food. And Sichuan is the size of France geographically, and so the variations that you find within a single province in China are so wide as to be incomprehensible. And really, if we think about what unites Chinese food, we might think, oh well, they like noodles and they eat lots of rice, but those are to me only surface level similarities. Which is to say that there's nothing more similar about one province in China eating that than there are, for various countries in Europe all eating bread, right? So I think that one trend that I do see, therefore, in Chinese cooking or Chinese cuisine in America is a recognition that all of these provinces are so discrete. And so Chinatown, Manhattan used to be a stronghold of Cantonese cuisine, which is, I think, most closely associated with the sort of Chinese American cuisine that Jewish people love. So things like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls with shredded carrots and cabbage and hot and sour soup. But now the Chinatown is seeing an influx of Shanghainese cuisine,
yes.
as well as, for example, the Chinatown in Brooklyn is mostly made up of cooks from Fujian province, which, I think in Fujian, they joke that their main export to the U.S. is people.
Mm-hmm.
So the cuisine that you get there, and even there, if you go to the Chinatown in Brooklyn, they speak the dialect of Fujian that I don't speak, so I sometimes can't communicate with them. And then Flushing, Queens, is just a hodgepodge of everything. And so that's one trend I see, is people don't say Chinese food anymore.
They talk about the
region,
yeah. for the problems. I am happy to open this up to questions from the audience. I'll be the moderator. Why don't we start in the front?
Okay, well, I just wanted to make, I'm mirroring that, right?
I write a blog about cheap eats, and I have a group of friends that go out to restaurants, and I just wanted to sort of make the point that, you know, I agree with that, the regional, you know, there's much more awareness also among foodies, though, you know, people who call themselves foodies, of regional Chinese food. And I think that, like, you know, the idea that Chinese food that used to characterize, you know, the Upper West Side Jewish diet is now giving way to Indian, Vietnamese, but it's also giving way to people who now recognize the difference between Sichuan food and Shanghainese food. And I think that, you know, that sort of comes along with it. And every year my friend and I have a Jewish Christmas, and we had it at a Sichuan restaurant. This year it was probably like 20 people. We shared everything. and I really do think it comes back to that tradition. But the tradition's evolving along with the increased awareness of regional Chinese.
And you know, the Chinese food that Jews might have eaten on the Upper West Side, that's really nowhere to be found in China.
Yeah.
that's mostly based on Cantonese cooking.
It's giving you very the lead there.
Yeah.
You don't have to think about that, that food
right.
exists nowhere except in America.
And, you know, I grew up partly in New Mexico, and there were a lot of Chinese buffets in New Mexico, and really all across the country there are Chinese buffets, and my parents and I were completely in love with these Chinese buffets. I mean, I would, you know, we would prepare for them like by wearing sweatpants and going and one year my grandparents came to live with us, and they figured out that if you went during the latter portion of lunch and stayed, that you could also get dinner. and that the sort of food that they served at these Chinese buffets was nothing like what my grandparents or my parents had ever eaten. It was so oily and sweet, and so, you know, appealing in that immediate way. I don't know. And that's what I think of when I think of the Jewish love affair with the Chinese food.
I also wanted to mention that we have a dish that's pork-coated shrimp that we call the yeshiva special.
there's a really good Chinese buffet on the way to Zuni from Albuquerque. Just take my word for it.
Okay.
And
we'll talk later. This
right.
is
but they have jalapenos in the chicken.
Cool. Jalapenos or green chili? Because green chili is like a big thing in Mexico.
I thought it was jalapenos, but it could have been green chili. You know, I mean, I was trying to stop there on the way to Zuni.
Okay.
This is why people come to this conference.
I'm wondering if there are regional differences in this country. I'm Jewish, I grew up in Atlanta and Miami Beach. In Atlanta, there weren't as many, I mean, there are now, but not as many Chinese restaurants, and so the affinity was more of like just anything but Jewish food. And in Miami Beach, it seems to be Italian food. You went out for dinner, it was like, well, you were Mario.
We thought about the Italian Lower East Side and the Jewish Lower East Side. We did try thinking about that, and then remembering back into our youth, we couldn't, our grandparents were all dead at that point, we couldn't find anybody old enough when we were doing this 25 years ago. And it seemed to me that I remember going to some of the Italian Lower East Side restaurants with my family, and there'd be Christian things in them.
Mm-hmm.
And it really irritated my father. Mm-hmm. He didn't mind Buddhas. Buddhas are cool. I mean, who would believe in Buddha anyway? So, which sounds disgusting, but that's what my father thought. But seeing stuff that was Christian was just very different. And I think that might be part of it. But if you start thinking about Atlanta and Miami Beach, you need a decent population to start supporting or to have people who are going to start a group of Chinese restaurants. One of the things about coming up from New York or going down from Boston, you know, because there's a sizable Chinatown there also, is that Chinese Americans, I think, know that it's possible to start restaurants in the various towns that still leave them accessible to their families. And one of the things that's most interesting, for instance, about the Flushing Chinatown and that extraordinary mix of people in Queens is that if you look at the subway lines, it's relatively easy to get from Chinatown to Flushing. I taught at Queens College for almost 20 years. It's hard to get to Queens College because then you have to change to a bus. But it's easy to get to Flushing and to that area of Flushing, which means that as you get some money, or if you want to move out of Chinatown, it's possible to move to an ethnic community and still get to work in Chinatown. And I suspect that there are those kind of connections between ethnic communities and where there are enough people to wind up having a restaurant. I've never tried charting it, though.
Yes, Ms. Pina, you know, it's funny that you said that about coming down from Boston and come to, because we live in Longmeadow, Massachusetts, which is straight up 91, and the Chinese restaurants there, and there are many because there's a big Jewish community there, too. Yeah, their families are in Flushing, and they like come up and have restaurants up here in Springfield. So it's kind of
travel.
But I think I just want to say that we went to the Dragon Tea every Sunday night, and it was a big night. We picked up one set of grandparents, another set of grandparents, you know. And I think the idea that not being Christian, I think, really would probably really get a nail up there.
I should
sort of a light bulb, I have to say.
I should say there's an exception to everything that I've said, because we have a really good Chinese restaurant in the stores, you know. And the Chinese family, it's an architect who's the cook, and they're Taiwanese, and they moved to stores from Oklahoma. How they did that is absolutely beyond me, but most of the wait staff comes from here.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
So I'm Chinese, born in Hong Kong. I'm Cantonese. We Cantonese believe we have the best food. I grew up in Manhattan, part of Lower East Side. I went to the High School of Music and Art. A lot of Jewish friends. My dad owned a restaurant. Nobody eats egg rolls, I hate to tell you that. Not real food. But I love some of the connections that you make. I think that the comment that the Jews kind of looked at the Chinese as superior to them tracks back to the immigrant status. You know, you had your Mayflower coming over with this Christian base, and then you had other followers, and the Asians were probably the last of the followers and really started out on the West Coast. And so those of us who immigrated to the East Coast were really late in the immigrant status. And, you know, at that point, low on the totem pole of financial security. So that's totally understandable. And there was another comment I wanted to make that, I grew up in New York, went to High School of Music and Art, a lot of Jewish friends there. So even those who are kosher make exception when they walk into a Chinese restaurant.
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely.
God, you know, we separate our plates at home. We don't turn on electricity, but the moment I walk into a Chinese restaurant, I'm eating that shrimp, pork, egg roll. And that's okay. That I just found completely hilarious.
That's very rare. I used to get a headache.
And so I found that really hilarious. And then the last comment I wanted to make was about Christmas. So my dad owned a Chinese restaurant. The only day it was closed was on Chinese New Year. And reaching out to a community, I don't think it's just about, I love your comment about the lonely Chinese and Jewish people. I think it's really just the lonely people. It's not really anyone that has even a Christian tie. My dad's restaurant, he owned three with his brothers. One was in the Bronx, a pretty tough neighborhood. One was in Harlem, and one was in another part of Manhattan. And most of them were really based in Hispanic found it Hispanic communities because my uncle lived in the Dominican Republic, so we served like chicharrón with fried rice. And that was a big hit. And so on Christmas, the restaurants were at capacity, if not spilled over. And all of these were Christian people without families. They were people who needed to be with people on a holiday that we all recognize as you shouldn't be alone.
I have some excellent point. I'm going to take a couple more questions. Red hair, red shirt, gentleman in the front.
Chi-Chi, I wanted to ask you, did you choose a vegetarian restaurant so that those who didn't want to eat non-kosher chicken or meat or counter pork would be able to eat that night?
I think that my producers were friends with the owners of this restaurant, and the restaurant was owned by a Jewish Chinese couple. So the guy was Jewish and the girl was Chinese, and they had always been lonely around the holidays. So it was mostly out of the kindness of their hearts that they opened up the restaurant. Most restaurants were closed. But I do have to say that there's a restaurant in Chinatown, Manhattan at the end of Mont Street.
Chinese connection with food. I think Don Siegel's not here, I guess.
Yes.
He deals with that. But the three theories I've seen floating around are, number one, the restaurant was open on Christmas time, so they could go in there and they weren't alone. Other one was, though, if you ate Chinese food, you're a recent immigrant, you showed that you were assimilated.
Yeah.
You really become American. And the other one was, that by eating, well, when you went to eat Chinese food, no matter what you wore, you were just another white man. So that there was no prejudice if you weren't to fill in or pass or whatever it is. What do you think of that? Is that reasonable?
I think those are actually things that Gay did talk about in her presentation of her work. I think those are all elements.
Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with the food, though. We were introduced to the food.
I don't know if that's true.
I don't know that's true. Because Cantonese food and the vegetables in Cantonese food, excuse me, can be bland, and no one has ever accused, Glitziana vegetables of being spicy.
Oh, no, spicy would only hide and mask the food.
Right, well, yeah, right. Of course you wouldn't want to do that with Jewish cuisine, so,
Of course. You know, I think The first Chinese came to the United States in the 1840s, and they were employed in rice paddies, where it was discovered they were not nearly as good workers as slaves. So the Southerners stopped importing Chinese to do that. And then the Chinese indeed went to the West Coast. And I think that one should not underestimate the kind of terrible things that happened to the Chinese on the West Coast in the late 19th century. There was an enormous problem in the gold mines. Because of the way that the Chinese farmed, they knew how to do sluices. And so when people were panning gold, the Chinese were particularly good at cooperating with one another and sluicing the gold. So the white people killed them. And when it came time to start gold mining by throwing dynamite, the Chinese were selected for those tasks, because the Chinese were familiar with dynamite, it having been invented in China for some reason. And that is an adequately dangerous enterprise. In the late 1870s through the early 1890s, there were riots in Oregon where where Chinatowns were burned down. We didn't have that as bad on the East Coast, but we didn't have gold mines.
I think it is my job to make sure that everybody gets out in time to go to the next panel if they like, or to catch up with a food truck that you might have missed, or the crepe station near Usedan. So I want to thank everybody for coming. We'll see you for the rest of the afternoon.